You're with Clement Maniatella.
702.
We start a conversation now. In fact, it's part three of our conversation on race. We did part one. We had Asanda and Professor Melissa Stain. And then we just didn't have enough time because there were so many calls and reflections from some of you guys. So then we decided we are going to have Asanda again on her own and have Professor Melissa Stain again on her own so that we have more of a discussion. So it's part three of our conversation on race. If you have noticed, since the beginning of this year, we have been on a reflective journey. We are not only talking and reflecting on race 30 years into our democracy, we are reflecting on things like the performance of our economy. There's a lot we've been reflecting on. There's a lot we're going to be reflecting on as we mark 30 years of our democracy. So we are going to talk today about what it means to be white in post-apartheid South Africa, 30 years into this democracy. And I'm so glad to have Professor Melissa Stain in studio with us. She's a national chair in critical studies at Wits University. She's done a lot of work around diversity. She's looked at the concept of whiteness in post-apartheid South Africa. As I said to you earlier, I read her paper on this sometime last year. So she's going to guide us through this conversation. Thank you, Prof, for making time. It's good to see you. Yeah, it's good to see you. I appreciate you making time. I know the last time we were speaking via Zoom, but when I saw you at Wits University last year and we had a conversation, I was like, I need you on the show ASAP. And I'm so glad that you've come to share your knowledge and insights with us. Thank you for making time. Good morning.
It's my very great pleasure.
Okay, so I always ask the listeners, because I know race is a contentious issue and there are people who get emotional, but I always ask the listeners to, I want us to always have rational, educational conversations. So this is not a moment to be screaming at people or a moment to be defensive about something. I just want us to listen and learn. And I want you to call in with your own experiences. Maybe you've got questions as well. I want you to feel comfortable and free enough to give us a call. Yeah? So let's have a rational conversation among ourselves. Let's learn and hear what Professor Melissa Stain has done and what the outcome of her work is. And also, let's ask questions. Let's give our own experiences as well. Now, Prof, often when I read about race and I listen to diversity experts, a lot of them believe that since the end of apartheid, there's been something of an identity crisis for white South Africans. That's that sense of uncertainty about what it means to be white. With the work that you have done, what have you found about that concept?
Yes, I think that is true, that in the old apartheid system, it was all constructed around white privilege, the maintenance of white privilege, and you know, in a way, sort of like a quite sealed off existence for white people, and sharing the sense of entitlement that comes with being white with whiteness globally. You know, but whiteness is an identity position that has been constructed from a position of power globally, historically. And then what happened in South Africa is that the demise of the white regime meant that white South Africans were no longer in that position of unequivocal power. That unequivocal position of domination. So that's actually quite a new experience for whiteness, if you can talk about whiteness in abstract like that. Because it is, as I say, it's a position that's normally or has been constructed from a position of power and domination. So that's quite an adjustment. It's quite a big thing for whiteness to suddenly find itself not in a position of unequivocal power, and particularly in relation to the power of the state, you know, because you find generally white people control the state where they live. And so not to be in that position where you control the state has been, I think, quite a shock.
How have, from your own research, how have many of the white people dealt with that kind of change and disruption in the system? Because as you say, our social and political structure since 1994 has changed, and it's, imagine, has altered their sense of identity. But then there's an argument that other people make that whiteness as a system seems to have maintained that defining weight, because you continue to see that it determines privilege and desirability. It's still a dominant category of identity and white life as a desirable standard, quote unquote.
Yes. Well, that's exactly true, is that that is where the power of whiteness still remains, in that ability to define and to have that definition accepted, you know. So the maintenance of those kinds of privileges have been what whiteness has absolutely worked to maintain. And again, one has to look at it globally. I mean, it taps into global whiteness. So, you know, the kinds of language that is used to maintain this kind of cultural power and discursive power are these international terms, you know, like standards and merit and, you know, globalization, you know, that indicate something that is actually controlled by whiteness internationally. And whiteness in South Africa works to maintain that status despite not controlling the state.
Yeah.
So it's actually it's a much, much more interesting context to study whiteness than anywhere else.
Yeah, your paper was just fascinating. I was just sitting up and at home and reading after midnight, because I just couldn't put it down. There are probably white people, some white people listening to us now, Prof, who are saying, well, I had nothing to do with what happened during apartheid. I had nothing to do with the system that still makes me enjoy the white privilege, or that still somehow puts me first. So what am I expected to do? And I'm tired of constantly hearing that I'm a beneficiary of this and that, when I had nothing to do with apartheid, and when I have not, in my own way, influenced the system to be designed in the way that it is.
Yes. Well, I think there's a lot that we could unpack in that, Clement. Because, firstly, you know, I was also around during apartheid. So I know, you know, it's not actually true to say that, you know, individual people didn't do anything. We like to sort of like retreat behind the argument that it was the state, it was the government that did all these things and we didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is that the whole apartheid apparatus could never have worked if we weren't manning it, as it were. The individual white South Africans were the people who were teaching in white schools, who were working in the police stations, who were running the civil service, who were using the restaurants and the beaches. And, you know, I mean, in every way, the system operated because white South Africans accepted it and fulfilled their roles within that system to maintain it. So it's not as if there was a separate system and then there were individual white people. You know, the system is there because white people were willing to operate it, as it were. So firstly, it's not true to say that we didn't have anything to do with it, just if we weren't actually in government. But secondly, for people, you know, 30 years post-apartheid, we want to say, you know, that was finished, that's finished, that's over. Why do you keep talking about race? We weren't...
Just,
you know,
move on,
and, you know, my children weren't born in that time, you know, those kinds of discourses. But the truth of the matter is, even if they, particularly if we're talking about young people now, were not responsible for what was done, it is still their problem.
Mm-hmm.
We inherit the problem. We inherit the problem because of our positionality.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a system that has built white privilege in a racialized country, in a racialized world, and that continues to privilege some people above other people, and inheriting we are the beneficiaries of the old apartheid system, which still continues through into current South Africa through the racialized privileges and disadvantage that operates, and that's our problem. We have to take that on.
So what can they do then? What can you do as Professor Steyn, who is white in South Africa today? Because part of the problem is racism is so institutional. It's so entrenched.
Yes.
It's so systematic that as an individual, I mean, no matter how learned and how woke, quote unquote, you are, that doesn't change the system. But individually, for some white people who feel, I want to play a role in somehow contributing to a change of some sorts, whatever that looks like, what is it that they can do as individuals?
Well, there's so much we can do. I mean, I think the important principle would be that we do have privilege. And the question then is, how do we use it? You know, obviously, the sort of knee-jerk way of reacting is to try and protect it, you know, to try and maintain it and prolong it, perpetuate it, you know. But the question is, you know, can we use the opportunities that we have, the privileges that we have, in order to change South Africa, and, you know, reconstruction and development? And you know, the thing about, again, Clement, we make this distinction between the institutions and individual people, but remember, we are those institutions, we ourselves. It's every committee that makes decisions. It's every decision that gets made by decision makers in organizations. These all create the institutions. So individuals can and do make a difference. It's how do we use our opportunities, you know, and that's a question of you know, awareness. You know, are we consciously and deliberately making decisions that are going to benefit the whole of the society and open things up, as opposed to being protective and you know, sort of enclave thinking?
I remember the last time I had you on the show together with Asanda. There's a lady who called us from Durban. I don't know if you remember, who says she had taken her husband, I think, to the hospital. And when she arrived there, and I'm just thinking at the top of my mind, I may not remember some of the details, but when she arrived there, this white woman with her husband, she arrives there, she finds a black man not being assisted by the receptionist, sitting on the bench. And then they're supposed to, and then they arrive, and then the receptionist then quickly gets up to assist the white woman and her husband. And the white woman says, oh, no, we are on the queue because we found this man here. And the receptionist said, no, that doesn't matter. I'll deal with that later. And the woman says, I called her out. And I said, no, that's unacceptable. You are not going to prioritize us when there's a man who has been sitting here. And the woman called us on the show and she was like, that's what I said. And I remember we were like, kudos to you, because I mean, look at how little that thing is, but it's a huge. It makes a huge difference.
Huge.
That's how, as an individual, you can make a difference. I've shared a story on air of how many years ago, I remember going to a bank with my mom, and my mother was standing on a queue, and there was a white woman behind us, and she felt the need for us to move aside so the white woman can go in front of us, because for some reason, for her, and my mom is old. She's in the village,
yes,
you know, her understanding, she's seeing a white woman there on a queue behind her, you know, I wondered what went through her mind to think, oh, let her pass. But you know, if there's a white woman who understands the context, is able to say, no,
that's right,
you stick there, you arrived here first. But some people do that, and they'll come in. So when we talk about things you can do individually, it's simple things like that, right?
Absolutely. You know, that simple things like that, it's also big things, you know. But I mean, at just an everyday level, those are important things. It's not accepting the privilege, you know, not colluding with a system that gives you those kinds of advantages, where you seem to be more entitled to immediate service. And like there's something wrong about a white person waiting while a black person is being assisted, but but it's sort of like completely normal for the black person to wait while the white person is being assisted. I mean, those are still the ways in which the sort of like advantaging of white people from the apartheid system still rattles around in our society. We still experience those things. And the big thing is to refuse to collude with it as a white person, to say, no, not in my name, not for me, don't do that.
I mean, I've got white friends who do that, whom I'm so proud of, because they are intentional about being aware, and they are intentional about also reading as well. So the question I want to ask you, Professor Steyn, is, because I sometimes find that there are some families who think, well, it's 30 years into a democracy, things have changed, there's equality, there's employment equity regulations, so everything is fine, so they don't see the need to talk to their children about race.
Yes.
Is it necessary to talk to kids about race? Because one woman once called and said, my child is 3 years old, why would I want to burden her at that age, or when she's six, with our own context and history, when I can just allow her to go into a community that has changed, that is quote-unquote, apparently non-racial?
Yes. So I think the question we immediately have to say is, are you burdening the child or are you capacitating the child? You know, I think it's understandable that people can feel that way, you know. But the fact of the matter is the world is racialized. South Africa is racialized. Racialized experiences are going to happen to that child. And it's much better for them to, you know, be conscious, be prepared. It's not about, you know, making them radical or you know, sort of like
an activist of sorts.
It's just about capacitating them. It's just about understanding the world that they're growing up in and that they're entering into, so that they're in a position to handle things, you know, with dignity and with self-confidence.
011-883-0702. You can engage us by calling us. You can also send us your WhatsApp voice notes. The number to send those to is 072-702-1702. We're reflecting on race. 30 years into our democracy, we have focused on blackness the previous time, and today we're having a conversation about what it means to be white in post-apartheid South Africa. As a white person listening to this conversation, what do you think, in your experience, means to be white in South Africa today? What is there, in your view, the identity of whiteness in South Africa today? Have you had to rethink that identity? What does it mean to be white today? Give us a call or send us your WhatsApp voice note. There are some texts coming through here on the WhatsApp line. And Elisiwe says, hi, Clement, please can you ask your guest, how can we access that paper that looks at whiteness that she has written? How can people access it?
Clement, well, I suppose if you go on Google Scholar, all right, and you look for the ignorance contract, that's what I think the paper that you refer to is called, the ignorance contract. Of course, I mean, it's not the only one I've written, but that I know is the one that you read.
Yes. Okay, so go there and find the ignorance contract, and that's where you'll go through the document. Here's a WhatsApp voice note that has come through.
Hi, so I'm a black girl with, you know, a lot of white friends, you know, and I just feel like, for me, it's basically just, it's the ignorance for me, and the ignorance that you are, the ignorance and just accepting that you are highly privileged and you're comfortable in that privilege. Going back to the complaining of, you know, service delivery right now and whatnot, you know, I feel like roles have reversed. But I think once you just accept and own the privileges and be willing to learn and to correct others when wrong is being done, you know, also as black people, we also have a role to play and a responsibility to play to just, like, you know, educate others and not be afraid to stand our ground and say, no, but this is not how it is.
Yeah, not afraid to stand our ground. And I think, Professor Steyn, the last time we also spoke about the inferiority complex that still exists among some black people, and understandably so.
Yes.
If you have spent hundreds of years in the colonial system and in the apartheid system where your identity as a black man, a black woman was suppressed, you were not allowed to be yourself, you were seen as, in fact, you were made to be seen as inferior. Of course, many years later, some people are still going to feel like that. And I find that when we are at dinner tables and we're having conversations and there's a white person who then says, yeah, and I've been at those dinner tables, a white person will say, yeah, my problem is we get stuck in the past. We must just move on. Mm. And you go, okay, what do I do?
Yes.
Do I try teach and get into it, possibly an argument, or do you keep quiet or keep it going? And I suppose that voice note says people must be willing to learn. And what I find is people get so defensive as soon as you try explain to them, no, it doesn't work like that. You don't move away from something like that. And that doesn't make you evil. It just says, let's understand where we come from and let's try in our own ways, fix and live together. So at those dinner tables, like it can be tricky sometimes to raise issues like that.
It can.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I don't know what do we do? Because you want to teach people, but you also want to ruin the dinner and end up in an argument about race. Yes.
So Clement, I think those are the sort of tricky balancing sort of judgment calls that we make all the time.
Mm.
I think that you do have to choose your teachable moments. Mm. You know, because sometimes, you know, also with a particular person, you can see that you're not really going to make any progress.
Exactly,
it's just not going to be, it's not going to be worth it. But on the other hand, you know, it's a very generous thing to do for black South Africans to be prepared to raise those things and to.
Because it's so
offer.
Exhausting as well. Eh?
It's exhausting. And it actually, as I say, it's a generous thing because it actually isn't the responsibility of black people to educate white people.
Yeah.
There's so much information out. We can do the education of for ourselves of the issues that come with having been racialized as white.
Mm.
And it really is the responsibility of white people to do that work, to become much more mindful, much more conscious, much more aware. And as you said, and as the speaker, the guest said, the ignorance is really what gets to people, you know, because it's white people often, when they are very ignorant, which that position of privilege tends to cultivate, is ignorance, you know, a lack of awareness of how society actually really operates and how whiteness is constructed in relation to blackness, and how you know, white privilege actually is built upon the disadvantage of black people, and the white people tend not to be aware of that, and so dealing with that ignorance is really, you know, a major breakthrough for white people when they actually really do get to understand that and get to realize their privilege. And that I find is the most difficult thing, is to get white people, just as your caller said, to actually acknowledge and accept and stop denying that that actually exists.
Yeah. After the headlines, I want you to respond to what, you know, some will say in that, oh, you think I've got white privilege? If really I've got white privilege, how do you explain that I was sidelined for that job because of that employment equity regulation? They went for a Clement who's black, even though I've also applied for the post. So we'll talk about that after the latest in Eyewitness News headlines. We've got calls coming through as well. 011-883-0702. I'll start with the calls and the WhatsApps.
Let's walk the talk.
This is Clement Manyathelo
on 702.
It's 23 minutes before 11 o'clock. We are marking 30 years of our democracy this year. It's a big milestone, and there are so many things to reflect on. And as part of the show, one of the things we've been reflecting on this year is on race. So today we're doing part three of our conversation on race 3 years into our democracy. We are on a reflective journey. Today we're talking about what it means to be white in post-apartheid South Africa, 30 years into this democracy. And I want to hear from you, as a white person, as a black person, what is the identity of whiteness in South Africa today? And how do you feel as a white South African in post-apartheid South Africa today? Your calls on 011-883-0702. You can send your WhatsApps on 072-702-1702. Let's start with Larry, who's calling us from Lenasia. Larry, good morning.
Hi, Clemens. How are you, Bud?
I'm all right, man. Go ahead.
Good, man. A quick one. I think the professor has come on the right time. I think you said she was before on the radio as well, but that's the first time I'm hearing her. I think she analyzed it very, very well. It's not that white South Africans are the problem. No, no, they are not the problem, unfortunately. Mm. They inherited the problem. And I like the simple examples that she gives, you know, as to how we can assist to understand that white people are not there just, you know, to patronize you, but it's more to understand that the pain that people have went through. And I'm really happy with the type of things that she's been talking about. A simple thing, you know, there's a black man in the queue and you as a white person are behind. They want to put you in front. I mean, to educate our person. No. You know, this is a person who's in front of me. Mm-hmm. And the same experience that you went through with your mom, you know? So I'm saying these are more the practicalization of things that how you can bring it down for people to understand. Because unfortunately, many white people do think that, you know, why must we worry about something that we were not there 30 years ago? Mm-hmm. Why should our children be worried? But the scared part is today, that you hear your child still using derogative words, then you wonder where it comes from. Mm. And I think for us, that becomes a problem.
Yeah.
That is my problem end of the day.
And I always say, it doesn't matter how woke you guys are as a family, as soon as your child steps out of that house, they're stepping into a society that is racialized. They're stepping into a society that's going to treat them differently based on the color of their skin. That still happens, which is why it's important to start talking to the kids about our history. I'm going to go to your WhatsApp voice notes on 072-702-1702. And then after that, we'll go back to some calls. I will get Professor Melissa Steyn to respond to the issue around white privilege and how some people say, how do I have white privilege? When in fact I've been sidelined for a job because of these employment equity regulations or triple BEE, and some people feel that is in fact reverse racism or reverse apartheid, so to speak.
Clement, thank you for this discussion. I think it is so valuable for us to see each other in the same light, no matter what the color of our skin. We have been in a country through apartheid that taught us that white is different to black. We are all the same underneath the skin. We are so fortunate to have the opportunity to learn from each other that we can grow in every part of our existence by learning from other cultures. We need to move on and make those small differences and make those small changes towards each other. And it's so important that we start doing it in the small places that we don't think is very important.
Yeah.
Hi, Prof. The genuine question from my side is using your words, you know, the ignorance contract, especially over our white counterparts. Is the ignorance part of the reason that they did not atone pre or post 1994? It is us black people who extended an olive branch. 30 years later, we are still doing it. There are pockets of people, you know, like yourself, who are willing to have those conversations, honest conversations. So post-apartheid white South Africa psyche, do you think it's because they didn't atone, they did not ask for forgiveness, they were given to them hence the ignorance and the yearning for apartheid. Thanks, Thato.
Yes, Prof.
Okay, well, let me just comment on the other two comments first. Firstly, well, the comment about our growing and seeing each other as the same underneath our skins. I think, you know, the caller makes a really important point that this is about learning. It is about growth. It's about learning from each other. And it's about dialogue. It's about getting into a dialogical relationship where we're willing to change and be changed and, you know, not remain fixed and rigid in our understandings of ourselves and our understandings of our context, of our country, our history. Very important, the history. But I do want to say to the caller that we do have to be a little bit careful around trying to flatten out the experiences and the histories of white and black South Africans. Because if we do simply say that we're all the same, that leads us into a trap where we might not recognize the ways in which racialization has created different life experiences for people and the ways in which those different life experiences continue to be shaped through race. And so we have to do, not be colorblind, but be race cognizant. We have to be aware of how it actually does operate in our society. But I absolutely agree with the caller that we have, in this country, we have a really special, unusual situation where we really can learn from each other, because whiteness is not so powerful that it can be just simply in a comfort zone, which it is in so many other parts of the world. For people to learn, for people to change, we know we have to be outside of our comfort zones. And there's enough of a sense of urgency for white South Africans to learn if they want to, you know. So that's a gift. That's a gift that we've been given. And it's up to us to actually take that. Then, of course, the ignorance contract and the listener who asks is part of the reason for the ignorance contract, the fact that black people extended an olive branch, but white people didn't atone. I have to say, I think that there's a lot of truth in that. The gestures of soul, if I can put it that way, have come largely from black South Africa and minimally from white South Africa, because white South Africa feels that their position is threatened and they don't want to give anything up, you know. And so there is a tendency rather to sort of shield their position than to reach out to black South Africa. And it's great, a great misfortune for us, you know. And not just, well, for our whole society, but also for white people as individuals, because they miss the opportunity to grow and develop and to receive the gift that is the new South Africa.
Oh, and you will never receive that gift until you actually acknowledge the dynamics and the history and the differences in how we were.
And Clement, so few people in history actually get the opportunity to make right what has been the injustices that have been done in their name historically. We've got that opportunity. It's the rarest of historical gifts. You know, and it's sort of sad when we see that people aren't able to recognize that.
Well, the first time I met you, we were at Wits, we were doing a dialogue on race, and I was emceeing and facilitating that. And I remember there was a white person who got up and said, "I don't feel welcomed in this country anymore."
Yes.
Which is where I want to bring in the question about, what do you say to white people listening to us who say, I really don't feel welcomed. I just feel like I'm under attack every day. I feel that even the laws that this government is implementing are, they put us on the back burner because you prioritize black people because of our transformation agenda. I've got the qualifications as well to come and be the manager of this government institution or of that entity, but they will rather go for a black person, and I feel that sidelines me. What do you say to people who are thinking like that?
Well, yeah, there's again a lot in what you said, Clement, but you know, the thing about the jobs, there's always the assumption that if a black person gets the position, it's at the expense of a more deserving white person. You know,
so
those are the things that we have to problematize,
yeah.
You know, because, I mean, you can be a white person, you can be qualified for a job, but that doesn't mean that you are entitled to get it, you know, and we have to have a broader vision in terms of understanding that it's in my interests as a white person that this country should grow and be sustainable and successful, and that can only happen if the whole base is broadened and black people come into their own. That's good for me, you know. So that assumption that you know, if a white person doesn't get the job, this is terrible and awful and unjust.
Mm.
But if the black person doesn't get the job, well, that's just the way it is, you
and
know. It's okay for black people to be unemployed. We sort of expect, you know, like large populations, you know, will just be out of a job, but no one white person should be out of a job.
Yeah.
You know, those are the kinds of assumptions we need to problematize.
Yeah, and to be clear, when Professor Melissa Steyn applies for a job and Clement applies for a job and Clement gets the job, even through the employment equity regulations, that doesn't mean they took me just because of advancing the transformation agenda. I must still be qualified.
Yes.
And in fact, if you guys know of any organization or company that takes a black person, even when they don't qualify for a position, just for the sole purpose of pushing a transformation agenda, that's wrong. In fact, that's illegal, and you must report that.
Yes.
But in fact, this thinking that, oh, because you didn't get the job because of those regulations, that it means they gave it to a less deserving person. No, there's another black person who's equally or more qualified than
exactly.
you, whom they have prioritized because of all of you are sharing the same qualifications, but because they want to push a transformation agenda. Okay, let's go to these WhatsApp voice notes.
A good day, Clement. Please ask the prof, how can you deal with people who often say that this government or your government, in reference to the ANC, because I'm black, then this government should be my government? Thanks, David.
Oh, those people who say your government, your people, we'll deal with that. That's another one.
Clement, I found your discussion with the professor extremely interesting. I'm an old, very old white South African. And what I believe, and I certainly don't want to indicate that I'm simplifying this discussion, but a very simple and a good place to start is to just practice absolute respect for every human being on the planet.
Mm.
It's a two-way street, and if we all respect people for who they are, not what they are, it will be a far better place. And I think we are very, very short of respect to our fellow beings in this country. I can only speak for this country.
Clement, is it not unfair to say that we should treat everyone the same, see everybody the same? A country like ours with so many different cultures, we have major cultural differences between what some people enjoy, how other people would do things, and it's not fair to say we should all be seen or treated the same. The differences between a Xhosa tribe and a Zulu tribe is different, yet we can still respect people for their differences, but we should not be forced to say everybody's the same. And very often these differences can cause animosity or tension, but if people can appreciate and see that people have differences, instead of us saying that we should treat everyone the same, why are we not trying to appreciate other people for their differences and learn those differences and understand those differences? We are fundamentally all slightly different.
You're right. We are different, and we must. In fact, I think that's the beauty of this country, is our diversity and how different we are. But just because you come from a different tribe or you're of a different race doesn't mean you are better than me or I'm better than you. And it's on that basis that we need to treat each other equally, right? Your reflections on these voice notes, Prof?
Yes. I think, yes, to first just start with the last caller, I've certainly never said that we must treat everybody the same, because that's why I talked about racial cognizance. That's about recognizing the difference in how a racialized society treats people, and therefore being aware that your experience of life as a white person is not the same as the experience of life as a black person has had, and to be respectful of that difference in terms of not making assumptions, not making statements that in some way just cut across another person's life experience and minimizes what they might have what they might be bringing into a situation. Mm. So that I think, you know, treating the same. I'm a professor of critical diversity studies. You know, I mean, it's all about understanding how do we actually work with difference in ways that does not give some people an unfair life opportunity as opposed to other people. But I also want to say that there are ways, of course, in which we are the same. We are the same in our human dignity. Mm. We are the same in our rights to have life, you know, the same life opportunities as everybody else, to be able to make our own contribution to society, to be recognized, to be heard, to be valued. In those ways, we are all the same, and that's where the treating people the same becomes important, you know, to recognize that. Practicing respect for each being, I think I've just dealt with that. And dealing with people who say, this is your government, well, I mean, that's just simply racist. And I think that you shouldn't accept it.
Yeah. You should see the messages I'm receiving on this side, Professor Steyn.
Really?
Greetings, Clements and 702. As somebody who was recently retrenched in a large corporate and it's difficult to find a job, I think we've still got to bear in mind that 9% of white South Africans, most of them have jobs. Unlike the 79% of the African population, who many are qualified and many of them several degrees and still no employment. And this includes doctors, people waiting to be placed in government hospitals. We have a systemic problem. We need to grow the economy. We need to work together, black, white, colored, Indian, whatever the color of your skin is. We need to come together to make the economy grow. And it's only once we understand that if everyone is employed, we can grow this country and we can make it a safer place for all our children. Then we will truly move forward together as the Rainbow Nation. We're nowhere near there. Nowhere.
Yeah, we're far from it. Thank you for those reflections. Johnny on the WhatsApp line also says, Clement, I did benefit from apartheid and I'm still benefiting. I would be doing the masses an injustice by not admitting that. Thank you for that, Johnny. Yes, but as Professor said, it's not, you don't stop at admitting. You know, what are you doing in your own individual way to try and work against that system? Another one says, Clement, I feel so sad that people do not recognize those of us who do agree and do understand and do acknowledge the white privilege situation that still exists today. I'm a 43-year-old Afrikaans white woman with three children, young children, that do stand up for racial unfairness, which can go both ways, by the way. And I teach my children the truth about the background of South Africa. They have a lot of empathy for the situation. Please do not generalize. There are many white people that do not stand for racial fairness. But being white and Afrikaans, you do not stand a chance or given the benefit of the doubt. You are always judged as racist. Racism has no place in the world. That's a message from Anonymous. And Anonymous, thank you for your reflections on that. And I don't think we've been generalizing at all. I mean, I spoke about my own friends who are white that I think have done the work. And in cases where there's subliminal, unconscious bias, I do point it out and said, hey, buddy, this is what you just said. This is what it means to me. And they're always willing to learn. I mean, there's Professor Stain here in studio who's talking to us about this particular issue. So I'm sorry if that's come across as generalization. That's definitely not our intention. Any reflections, Prof?
Yes. I'd like to respond to the woman who spoke about the systemic problems and the need to grow the economy. And here I want to say that, you know, I often feel that the deal that was made, the unspoken deal that was made in 1994, was that black people would forgive white people for apartheid and for the injustices and the cruelty and suffering that people had been put through, and that on the white people's side, they would open up the economy. I think that is the actual deal that was made, although it was not actually articulated. But that's what should have happened. That's what should be happening. And I think that as white South Africans, we do have ways in which we can ensure that that we are providing opportunities for black people and for black businesses to grow. For example, I'm putting up solar panels on my house. You know, do I just simply default to a white company, or do I actually give a black-owned company an opportunity to do the job? You know, I have actually done that, and wonderfully, I don't even want to say wonderfully competent, because that implies that they might, that I think that there might not have been. But that would be the underlying fear that white people who've been racialized to understand black people as being less competent would have, you know. But, I mean, I have that opportunity. I can make sure that there is, you know, in a position like that, I can give a black person an opportunity to grow their business.
Yeah.
And there are, again, these are decisions, choices that we make, you know, just on in our everyday life. And we can do much more to do that, to give the opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just want to quickly say to the person who phoned in about being an Afrikaans person and never getting the benefit of the doubt, that, yes, I mean, of course, there is something sad about the way in which people try to simplify complex social analysis by just going with stereotypes. And that's never okay.
It's not.
But having said that, it's very difficult to actually think through sometimes the question of the collective and the individual, because as white people, we are positioned socially in a position of privilege, and you know, it's quite correct for us to be seen that way.
Yeah. Professor Melissa Stain, we are out of time, but thank you for making time and for handling this discussion with so much care and sensitivity. It's been insightful to me, and I believe to the listeners as well. Thanks for making time.
Thank you very much.
Forget